Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we are here on this Monday together, as we are every Monday. And Anthony, of course, has his own program here every Friday in this time slot, 5 to 7 p.m. Joins us here on Mondays. And we're here every day, Monday through Thursday, to bring you the kind of news information you get nowhere else on the dial here in the area. But before we tell you about that, we want to talk with our guest. Who we called this morning. He writes in the Huffington Post. He is a political activist. He has written the book, Listen to Your Mother, Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. And what caught my attention last week was reading his article, The Dominance of the Financial Sector Has Become a Mortal Danger to Our Economic Security. And Robert Creamer, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Hey, good to be with you.
Great to have you here. So,
great.
I tell you, I mean, I want you to outline this for our listeners who may not be looking at the Huffington Post, or they should, because tons of interesting stuff that pop up there. But the power of the financial sector, as you write about them in America, I think people don't realize how it's changed since the 40s. When you write in 1947, the financial sector represented only 2.5% of our gross domestic product. It's risen to 8%, but that's just the beginning of the story.
Yeah, that's really true. I mean, just to give you the most concrete example, I guess, between 1973 and 85, the financial sector never earned more than about 16% of all domestic profits generated by business in the United States. And in the last 2 years, the last decade, it's closer to 41% of all profits by all businesses earned in the United States are the financial sector. And we're talking now about banks, we're talking about mortgage banks, we're talking about investment banks, we're talking about Wall Street in particular, and insurance companies, all of whom deal not in the production of goods and services, but in basically the manipulation of money. And in particular, these Wall Street investment banks, the people who basically sunk the economy last year through this reckless, speculative bubble that they created. I mean, these folks, you know, don't produce a lot. They're basically about running a big casino that they're betting America's future on.
I think it's interesting, Robert. This is Anthony McCarthy. I was reading the piece you wrote about the bailout bonuses on Wall Street, and I was amazed. You make this analogy, and I guess I never really thought about it this way, but it's very significant that these money managers really aren't. They're not in the business of giving or producing a product, that they really run, like you said, almost like a casino. It's all based on risk. And as the government's been bailing them out, we've even taken that part out of the equation for them. But yet they're still making millions of dollars hand over fist, in addition to the bailout dollars that we've given them to shore them up.
Yeah, what's really, I think, infuriating to average people, and we saw this in the bonuses of AIG, you know, here are guys who made huge mistakes for all of us. That is, whose behavior caused the collapse of the American economy, and have cost millions of jobs and people's 401ks and their incomes. But now, right now, they're back on their winning ways. That is, the bailouts, which I think the government felt under both the previous administration and the current one, were necessary to prevent the complete meltdown of the financial system, were used by these outfits to put them in a position where now they can just make oodles of money and it's not on banking. Let's be clear.
That's
the
right.
Community banks and the credit unions and such, they haven't had a very good quarter the last quarter. You know, they're losing money. They're losing money. A lot of them are failing because there's not as much demand for, or at least not the kind of demand that they'll loan to, you know, for loans. And a lot of people are defaulting on loans. So that's what they do for a living, regular banking. Whereas the Wall Street sector, freed up by the elimination of the restrictions that used to pertain in the United States against the combination of banking on the one hand and these speculative activities on the other, they're just back at speculation and trading. And they set aside, Chase, J.P. Morgan Chase, set aside, what's the number, $28 million, is that right?
Yes.
Yes.
No, I'm sorry, $2.6 $2.7 billion.
That's right.
In compensation for its investment bankers for the third quarter, a 28% increase. Unbelievable.
So the question is, since, as you wrote, and it's always amazing about how wealth runs in this country, that between 2002 and 2007, two-thirds of all the income gains in America were made by the top 1% of Americans. 1% of Americans.
So, right. I mean, one of the reasons that's true is because of this, you know, the financial sector is this big vacuum cleaner that has been sucking up all this growth and all what growth we had. Most of it went to them.
So if you take that, I mean, I was reading, just before we went on the air, there was a poll released by the Washington Post. And the poll that released by the Washington Post showed that now the 57% of all Americans support a public option.
Right.
All right? And that the numbers are growing exponentially around that issue. Yet the power of the financial industry, the power of the insurance companies and their lobbies control the situation that people don't. So, I mean, when you write the book, and I think, I mean, when you, the book you wrote, which tells people to stand up, listen to your mother. I love the title. Listen to your mother. Stand up straight. My mother always said that she put a pin in my back all the time. Stand up straight.
Go,
how progressives can win. So how do people start responding in face of the huge, the enormous financial might of the lobbyists in Capitol Hill and the large capitalist industries who actually dictate policy?
Well, I got to tell you, I mean, I think the first way we responded was by throwing a lot of these guys out of office and electing Barack Obama president. I know a lot of people say, well, gee whiz, a lot of his people are all tied into Wall Street. All that may be true, but fundamentally, this president has the same values that people like I do, and I think progressives around the country do. And I think, for instance, I think we're going to get a public option, a strong public option out of the insurance reform bill in the end of the game.
Really?
Because of what you say. It's politically popular, and there are an awful lot of Democrats in the House and Senate who are going to stand tall and say, you know, we're not going to let these guys roll us again.
Now, that's something you have an interesting philosophy about, because there are a lot of people who are progressives who are angry at Obama, who are angry at the president, angry at what's going on in Congress, kind of, and as you write, throwing up their hands and saying, public plan's going to lose. You're saying the exact opposite. You're saying this is a defeatist attitude.
Well, yeah, I think it's a defeatist attitude. I also think it's, you know, it plays into the hands of our opponents. You know, the public option is, I mean, the insurance guys would love nothing better than to everybody say, oh, well, that's not going to win, so it's off the agenda. I mean, it's our job to say, no, it's inevitable. We're going to have it. The real question is what we're going to have, not whether, and make sure it is center stage in the negotiations. It'll be in the House Senate Conference Committee, not kind of off to the side as some quixotic idea whose time has not come. I mean, most people, as you say, in the United States favor a public insurance plan to compete with these runaway insurance companies that are part of this financial sector. And I think that's what we're going to get in the end of the day, assuming that Democrats in both the House and Senate who favor it, and most of them do, stand firm. And when they do, the White House is going to say, all right, this is it, guys. You're going to stand in the form. You're going to stand in the way of health care reform or not? And I think we're going to get it, and we're going to get a good bill.
Robert, I believe you, and I certainly hope that the Democrats and the leadership in Congress and the White House are listening to you and take that attitude. But I'm thinking back to some of the writing you've done about Wall Street, about the regulations that were put in place. They were very weak, and therefore, that's how AIG and a lot of these other groups have really been able to slip right back into old bad behaviors. That's the definition of insanity, doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different outcome. Congress could have put more benchmarks in place. They could have put more restrictions in place, but they didn't. And that's why I guess a lot of progressives are concerned about how much they will, as you say, stand up when it comes to the public option.
Well, you know, look, there's no doubt that the financial industry in particular has its tentacles all over the United States and is a huge powerhouse when it comes to influencing political actors. I mean, the problem they have is, you know, I mean, last year was a real catastrophe.
Oh, it's horrible.
I mean, you know, and it's not lost on most people that that's true. You know, one of the things I just think is very important is to never give people a sense, well, we really can't win. Mm. And on the one hand, and on the other hand, that what we're proposing is bizarre, radical, kind of marginal stuff. I mean, you know, the first financial meltdown that happened in the United States history was in 1792. Happened when George Washington, I guess, was still president. About every 15 years after that, there was a bubble and a collapse, a credit collapse, until 1932, when finally we had the mother of all those credit collapses,
that,
you know,
that,
the Great
Depression, that's right.
And the Securities and Exchange Commission was created to regulate what was then the entire, equities market. FDIC was put in place to guarantee deposits in banks so you didn't have runs on banks. The Glass-Steagall Act was passed, a critical element that basically said if you're going to be a banker, you got to be a banker. You can't go be in a speculator in these exotic whatevers. And of course, the Fed had been in place since 1913, and the Fed was given considerably more power. And in the end, 50 years, we didn't have a financial breakdown. I mean, until along comes Ronald Reagan, and his gang deregulates the savings loan industry. And it didn't take but what 2 years before we had the savings loan crisis.
Right. Mm.
And you'd think that would have given everybody pause and said, well, geez, that didn't seem to work too well. But these guys, you know, they had gotten all these folks both on both sides of the aisle, I admit, to believe their baloney that we had all these innovative new financial products and the private sector was the best thing going. It could do it all better than government, and we ought to let them free. And so we eliminated Glass-Steagall. Unluckily, I just point out, my wife, Jan Schakowsky, who's a member of Congress, was one of the few people to vote against that.
Yes, she was. She's one of the leading progressive voices in the U.S. Congress, you might add.
Well, thank you. and it gets, she, but, you know, eliminated Glass-Steagall, and it was not long, you know, after that, here comes the bubble. And we had first round was the tech bubble, and then second one was, of course, this real disaster in the housing markets and these all these derivatives. Now they passed a bill in the Senate the House Financial Institutions Committee yesterday or last week, out of that committee, to regulate derivatives. Hit a bunch of holes in it, which hopefully will get fixed as we move either to the floor or in conference. This time, I suspect we may see whereas usually the House probably gets better stuff done. I think this time the Senate Banking Committee may do a better job at tighter regulation. In the end, we got to regulate all these derivatives. I mean, this huge sectors of our trading was totally unregulated. I mean, AIG was the great example, right? They were selling these credit default swaps, which were basically insurance products.
Yeah.
But they weren't subject to any insurance regulation because of the way they were set up, and they weren't subject to any kind of other oversight. And so they'd said to people, basically, if the price of a stock drops to, or the underlying whatever it was, the underlying item, fell below a certain level, we'll make it good for you. That's an insurance product. But they didn't have any capital requirements. So when they were called upon to make good, they didn't have the money to pay up. And everything looked like it was going to really collapse.
Well, we're going to take a short break here and we're going to come back to talk more. We have to talk about the EAA and talk about your book, Robert Creamer. And I want to really explore when we come back some in greater detail how powerful this industry is, what it's doing to America, and what the strategy is to address this for all of us. So stay with us for all that. Remind you, Urbanite Radio Stories on the Mark Steiner Show are made possible by Baltimore Mediation, the first mediation firm in the state of Maryland specializing in separation and divorce and business and workplace conflicts. Located right here in Baltimore, go to www.baltimoremediation.com. And Anthony McCarthy and I will be back in just a minute to tell you more about how to support your public radio, WEAA. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner.
I'm Anthony McCarthy.
And we are talking, and this is part of our program.
I almost kept going there for a moment, Mark.
to Robert Creamer, who writes for the Huffington Post, author of the book Listen to Your Mother, Standing Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win, and who has the famed claim of being married to one of the most progressive fighting congresswomen in the United States Congress.
Robert, is your wife, Congresswoman, is she running for the Senate in Illinois?
No, she thought seriously about it and decided that she would stay in the House because, frankly, you know, she and I both agree this period in history, you know, both of us have been working this a long time, and passing universal health care, regulatory reform, immigration reform, questions like a new energy policy, that's a big deal. And she would have had to devote herself full time to essentially raise money and run it for the Senate instead of the process of trying to win those things and get them shaped in a progressive way. And so she decided she'd stick where she was.
Well, one of the things that happens, though, in America is that the media and advertising, since it's so controlled by the wealth of financial institutions in our country and insurance company, can turn people around. And so you make things that are very logical statements, like why a public plan needs to be in the United States of America, or why we have to re-examine our foreign policy in terms of Afghanistan and Iraq, or the issues of where we put the stimulus money and putting people back to work in America, rebuilding our schools, rebuilding our bridges, taking care of our inner cities. They become kind of made to appear fringe arguments. Do you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Pushed to the
right.
side. That's part of the problem.
Because right. I mean, I think it's just hugely important that we, as I said, stand up straight and say, you know, we're the mainstream here. I mean, this is the tradition of the traditional progressive frame of values. That's what's underlay most of the last century in the United States, from 1932 to the mid-70s. That's how, I mean, during that time, we saw a huge expansion of wealth for everybody and a big reduction of the discrepancy or the inequalities in American society. And then, of course, there was kind of the Reagan counter-revolution that started off mid-70s and early 80s and continued until Barack Obama won presidency. I mean, even when Bill Clinton was in office, you know, there were then two ideological, you know, teams on the field, but we were still on the defensive during that period, you know, and remember, he even made that speech where he said the era of big government is over, you know?
Yep.
So we got to establish the fact, once again, that we are the majority. We're the mainstream of the way of American tradition. Now, my friend Mike Lux, who also writes on Huffington, wrote a book earlier this year, published a book called The Progressive Revolution, How the Best Things in America Came to Be, which kind of looks at the history of progressive change in American history. And he found one thing that's just really important, it seems to me, there were five periods in American history where most of the changes have happened. That change happens in big change moments, in clusters. My view is that we are, notwithstanding all of the counterattacks by the special interests, in the midst of that kind of big change moment. And every one of them involved these kind of struggles. You know, what is it? Was it Frederick Douglass who said power surrenders nothing without a struggle?
That's right.
That's right.
Well, that is so right, you know? But on the other hand, I think, you know, I personally believe the time is now that we're going to see, we look back on the period we're in for the next couple of years here and say, wow, that was a time we made really fundamental progressive changes in America to make it more democratic and more and fairer and more prosperous for our kids.
I mean, if you look at what's going on right now, and the Huffington Post wrote about it today, and we were talking about this morning in terms of conversations we want to have this week, that now 10%
of
all the people living in homeless shelters in America are working Americans who lost their homes.
Through foreclosure.
Amazing.
That's madness. I mean,
just madness. Just madness.
You know, and so there has to be a response to that. And,
yes.
And so the question is, I mean, when you look at that and you look at next to the things that you wrote about in terms of where the money is going and how many billions of dollars these banks are, the profit being made by Morgan and the banks who've gotten all this federal money, making more profits they have in, what is it, 10 years in the second quarter?
Yeah.
Over $3 billion?
Mm.
Something's...
Well, I think this is a... though all of those things, I hope, are going to be wake-up calls that will help propel changes in the way we regulate and structure the relationship between the financial sector and the rest of American society. I mean, a Consumer Financial Protection Agency, for instance, which is under consideration now, and it would really change the ability of these credit card companies to give teaser rates that end up ripping off people huge quantities of money. It would change the ability of these, and this is, smaller fry stuff, but it really impacts lower-income people, these payday loans. I was with somebody the other day who got a $500 payday loan, and after 2 years had spent $2,000 of interest because she had to rotate it, roll it over.
That should be illegal.
That should be illegal. That is just unconscionable, right? But that's how a lot of the way the financial sector has sucked all this money into their orbit is through these kinds of things that are just outrageous. And of course, credit cards are just fraught with these deals. I mean, changing interest rates on past balances just willy-nilly, right, without any, restriction. All of those things have got to be changed. I think there is a will to do it, certainly on the part of the administration, on the part of a lot of Congress, certainly on the part of many American people. The other side is going to fight back like crazy. But if we stick it out, we can win this.
Robert, we only have about a minute left, so I can't set this question up. But I read a piece you wrote earlier this month about Obama winning the Nobel Peace Prize and what an opportunity this was, you thought, for progressives, for America, really, the American people. And that it really spoke to how they see this new administration and the hope that they're placing on Barack Obama's shoulders. Are our expectations too high? Are progressives expecting too much from Barack Obama?
Too much of Obama?
Mm-hmm.
I hope not. I mean, I say that advice. I mean, I've known Barack Obama a long time. I think he shares progressive values. The difference between, this is not a guy whose fundamental instincts are to triangulate or to be middle of the road from the point of view of his goals.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think it is absolutely fair for progressives to question the strategies he's undertaken, whether or not he's tough enough, whether or not he's, the tactics. But the difference with a president like Obama is, I mean, he's our guy from the standpoint of sharing our values. And I know there are a lot of people out there who are progressives who don't agree with that or don't believe that, but I do. Mm. And I think that gives me a lot of hope that if we stick together and do the battle we got to do and take these special interests on and give them no quarter, that in 3 or 4 or 5 years, we'll look back and say this is one of the most productive periods of change in recent American history.
Robert Cremier, took us right to break. Good timing.
Great timing.
Thank you so much for being with us, Dave. We look forward to having you back on.
All right, bye.
Thank you. Robert Cremier, we've been talking to, author of the book, Listen to Your Mother, Stand Up Straight, How Progressives Can Win. And we're going to come back from this very brief break. We're going to tell you how you can win by supporting your public radio, WEAA. I want to remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the University of Maryland Marlene and Stuart Greenbaum Cancer Center, an NCI-designated cancer center providing research, treatment, and education to further the prevention of and cure for cancer. Online at www.umgcc.org or call for more information at 1-800-888-8823. I'm Mark Steiner.
And I'm Anthony McCarthy. And we're in the middle of our membership talk. Oh, we're done with that.
We're done with that.
Yeah,
we're talking about
I'm getting confused.
The world now and your life.
And life and your life. Pocketbook. And
your pocketbook.
Oh, brother, you don't even want to talk about that. I see some moths fly out of that thing every time I open my wallet. Some little caterpillars come out. Yeah, but Mark, it was fascinating. Robert Creamer has hit on something that I hope that progressives, and you know, I have a strong appreciation for all political views.
Yes.
As long as it's rational and reasonable and you can have a conversation. But Robert Creamer really is saying that progressives can stand up when it comes to our war policy, when it comes to our economic policies, when it comes to a whole litany of issues that are facing us, not just in Washington, not just with decision makers, that we have to make when we're in our home about how we're going to budget, whether we're going to renegotiate our loans, whether we're going to, you know, that statistic, Mark, that you gave about foreclosures in this country and the people who are in homeless shelters. 10% of all families in shelters right now are in the shelters are in the condition they are in. This was reported today on HuffingtonPost.com.
Right.
Are due to losing their homes.
And
in the richest country in the world,
mm-hmm.
we have such an outrageous number of people who are hurting.
I'm going to give you another interesting statistic for people to contemplate on. You can join us here also at 410-319-8888 to join the discussion. 410-319-8888. There's a lot going on here in America right now with the power of huge capital and money controlling the agenda of America. The question is, how do you take that agenda back in the name of our society and our future? I'll give you another thought on that in just a moment. But a stat I just saw coming across from the Public Justice Center that 40% of all the people losing their homes in America due to foreclosures are renters.
Wow.
Which means those people go directly to the street.
Mm-hmm.
40% of the people who lose their homes in America because companies that own apartment buildings go under and belly up because of their debt.
And so you have no option at that point because you're a renter.
You're a renter.
That's amazing.
So what do you do about that? 410-319-8888. I want to know what your thoughts are about where we take this. Now, this is it's a pleasure line, the same phone, but I think we have the phone thing worked out so you can call in and make your comments on the air. 410-319-8888. And we want to ask you to make a pledge before you make your comment. 410-319-8888. You know, we have this. The situation in America, I think, is getting, in many ways, very dire. We are at a cusp here. That America could, we could lose it all, or we could gain it all.
Mark, I remember on your program, and certainly on my program, there was some talk about what we can do right here in Baltimore, and there were some members of the city council who were trying to buy more time for folks when it came to foreclosures. But some of the most heart-wrenching stories, just like that statistic, Mark, that you just read to us, was of people who were renting properties,
right,
in apartments or in homes, where the owners of those properties fell into foreclosure, and they did not get notified about it until they needed to be out of the property. And they had nowhere to go. They had absolutely nowhere to go or no one to call. And so this is not just some pie in the sky conversation. This is really touching people in this community, here in this city, people that we know, people that are part of our neighborhoods and our community.
410-319-8888. What are your thoughts about where we're going? Let me read you something that I didn't know. I went to see Michael Moore's Capitalism, which is a good film. And I enjoyed watching him. He's made better films, but I think this is a good film. At any rate, there's something in there that happened that they had Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
That's right.
Before he died, created what he called a economic bill of rights, a second bill of rights for America. He said, when we finished fighting World War II, we're going to demand another bill of rights. And let me tell you what Franklin Roosevelt said, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and see if you think it fits in America now, and how do we get to Franklin Delano Roosevelt's America. He said that we have come to a clear realization that true individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. Necessitous men are not free men. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictatorships are made. When people fear these things, they turn to demagogues and go that way. Is that what's going to happen to us? In our day, these economic truths have become accepted as self-evident. We have accepted, so to speak, a second Bill of Rights under which a new basis of security and prosperity has to be established. Let me give you some ideas he has. Maybe you want to read some of these with me, Anthony.
No.
I don't know. The right to a useful and remunerative job in the industries or shops or farms or mines of this nation. The right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation. The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living. The right of every businessman, large or small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad. The right of every American to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health. The right to adequate protection from economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment. The right to a good education. All these rights spell security. And after this war is won, we must be prepared to move forward in the implementation of these rights to the new goals of human happiness and well-being. America's own rightful place in the world depends in large part upon how fully these and similar rights have been carried into practice for our citizens. That's what President Franklin Delano Roosevelt said in 1945, just a month before he died, before World War II ended. So what do you think about that? What do you think about Franklin Delano Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights? 410-319-8888. And I'm trying to get back here if this mouse would work. There we go. Here we go. Come on, mouse. 410-319-8888. Anthony?
Well, I think that it's amazing as you were reading that, Mark. That is a call to action that could have been written right now for this day. I mean, the fact that people are reaching a level of discomfort and meltdown in their personal and their professional lives that really put the entire country at risk. I mean, we know that individuals are at risk, but I love this. It is amazing that what Franklin Delano Roosevelt wrote in 1945 is so relevant today.
Yes.
It's shocking, actually, that we find ourselves in this position again.
Let's go to the phones. I can't see who's calling because nothing's up on the screen.
Oh, he's saying there is no
People have left. Join us here at 410-319-88. There's a call coming in, but they're on this line. Hello, across the glass. We do have a call, 410-319-8888. But my screen has gone kaplooey here. This is why you have to support public radio, so our screens don't go down like this. 410-319-8888. So we can get that mouse to work. But, I mean, to me, these are issues. What Franklin Delano Roosevelt wrote... when he spoke of that second Bill of Rights, he's talking about a vision of America that we've lost. So do you think we should get that vision back? And how do we get it back? How do we get to this place where we go to a new America? Just bring them online, 410-319-8888. And whoever the caller is, let's hear what your thoughts are. He's pulling them up now, and we'll hear your thoughts. You there, caller?
Hello.
Hi. I'm sorry, I didn't get you. What's your name?
My name is Sam.
Sam, welcome.
I'd like to make a comment on the Franklin Roosevelt Second Bill of Rights. It's excellent and it should be implemented, but the society we're now living in is too far too late, and honestly, that probably was led up to his death, just by the fact of him creating this bill.
All right, we
just lost him. The phones are ringing.
The phones are ringing.
But, Mark, it's very important that people get this information. And it reaches us at a level where I think that this idea of this economic bill of rights, this people's bill of rights when it comes to our economic policy. Oh, we're getting that music, Mark. It's time for us to go make another pitch and tell people why it's important to be part of this relationship that we have here at WEAA.
We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Mark Steiner here with Anthony McCarthy, and it is time to continue our conversation with you all about what I just read, which was Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Bill of Rights, a second Bill of Rights he proposed for America and was not thought about after he died. Maybe it's time for us to resurrect that and have a discussion about what our rights are as Americans and what we should expect from our society and what our society should expect from us as well.
That's right.
Because we have to give back. 410-319-8888 is number here. Let's go to the phones.
Yeah, let's do it, Mark.
Terrence in Pikesville, you're on the air.
This is a real honor. I'm one of your 15 for this hour, by the way.
All right. Thanks, Terrence.
I just want to say that my family just saw Michael Moore's film last night, and I was just bowled over by Franklin Delano Roosevelt's Economic Bill of Rights, and also by the sheriff that refused to enforce evictions, and by the even the bishop going down to serve communion to the people that refused to leave their jobs until they got paid.
Oh, the workers in Chicago.
There were a couple things in that. And I want to underscore what your guest was talking about before, that this really is an important moment, that the reason that Roosevelt could propose those things was because of the extraordinary suffering during the Depression that all the poor folk had gone through. And what's going on now in this country, it's just clear as a bell that this kind of gambling on Wall Street that's been called derivatives, etc., is a travesty on any kind of a just society and a decent economy. And it's just absolutely important, extraordinarily important for people to speak to their elected representatives now, for there to be a groundswell now coming out of the suffering that's going on. Otherwise, I'm afraid of more business as usual. But it's fantastic to hear you two. It's fantastic to hear your guests from the Huffington Post. And thank you. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you so much for that call.
Thank you, Terrence.
It's a great deal to hear our listeners call in like that. We want to hear your thoughts at 410-319-8888, just about where we are. I mean, you know, both Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who said to labor leaders in America in the 1930s, look, I support what you're saying.
He sure did.
But you got to go out and push me and fight
make
for what you want.
Make me do it.
Make me do it. And Abraham Lincoln said the same thing to Frederick Douglass. Abraham Lincoln wasn't like a raging... Abraham Lincoln may have had his racist qualities, but he respected Frederick Douglass. And he said to him, push me, make me do this. Whether it was... calling for the abolition of slavery or allowing black men to fight in the Civil War. And he pushed, and he made Abraham Lincoln do it. That's our job now.
That's our job. And, you know, a lot of people, Mark, when we challenge not just the president, when we challenge progressives to be everything that they should be and be engaged at the level they need to be, people will call in and sometimes challenge us. But really, it is our job to push Barack Obama, to push George W. Bush when he was in office, to push the leadership of Congress. No more rhetoric. Let's move ahead on an agenda for the American people. Wherever you fall on the political scale, wherever you fall on whatever your political ideology is, what do you believe is in the best interest of the American people, and how do we get there? Just like President Roosevelt, just like President Lincoln and others, when they said, look, push me, make me do it. That's our job right now.
And I would encourage you all just to go to, if you Google FDR's Bill of Rights, it pops right up. The Economic Bill of Rights that he said in January 11th, 1944, in the middle of trying to end World War II. Just read it. Think of what that means. And we're going to come back and have a major hour discussion with people who are talking about that and have people on all sides, but really kind of discuss, is this the kind of America we want, and how do we get there? And I think that it's our time to really think about this. And so, folks, before we run out of time here, I want to encourage you all to call 410-319-8888. Show your support for your public radio, WEAA. And remind you, the Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Anthony McCarthy, thank you so much for doing
this. Great being with you, as always,
good to have you co-hosting. Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producer is Justin Levy. We're engineered today by Brian Boone. The Cornell West segment was edited by Andrew Epic at Clean Cuts. Our interns are Judith Lloyd, Brian Boone, Richard Good, Gay Pinder, and Devin Finley. Our theme music is by Wall Matthews of Clean Cuts. to hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear new additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and